Dr. G. Nelson, are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right. I think we're going to have an interesting discussion. And
sure.
I'm somebody, and I think a lot of our viewers are the same as me. We're concerned with any threats by anyone, especially a foreign party, to California's environmental strategies and goals. And I think a lot of us are also interested in job opportunities and certainly the impact of any development that threatens our jobs. So, does that sound like the scope of what we're going to talk about today?
Indeed it does, Michael.
All right. Now, I'm about to do one thing, and I'll be back to you in 1 second, okay?
Sure.
All right, Dr. Nelson, tell me something. You have a PhD. What did you get the PhD in?
I earned my PhD in the field of radiation biophysics in 1984.
So that means you know an awful lot about nuclear energy.
Absolutely, and its interaction, the ionizing radiation, and its interaction with biological systems, such as you and I.
All right, and where do you work or live? What part of this state of California?
I live in the California Central Coast in a city called San Luis Obispo. And I also live about 8 miles, as the crow flies, from California's sole remaining nuclear power plant, which is called Diablo Canyon Power Plant. It's owned and operated by Pacific Gas and Electric, one of the largest publicly owned utilities in the United States.
I'm glad you brought that up. I've been hearing that PG&E, the operator of that plant, is planning to shut it down. Am I correct?
Yes, that's their plans. They're going to see if they can get away with it, and they've been trying all manner of things to try to convince Californians that it's a done deal, and we just better get used to more emissions and higher power bills, because that's what's coming if the plant closes.
All right, now I heard what you said. Let me just ask, how much clean energy, what percentage of California's clean energy is provided by Diablo Canyon?
From what I understand, it's around 21% of all of California's zero carbon, and I like to use that term better, zero carbon energy comes from Diablo Canyon Power Plant. This is an incredibly powerful plant. It produces as much power as 5 Hoover Dams, or for those that are into solar power, there's a huge 9.5 square mile facility visible from space called the Topaz Solar Plant in eastern San Luis Obispo County, and Diablo Canyon produces 14 times as much power as that $2.2 billion plant.
All right, so let me just go back to one number you said. Did you say Diablo Canyon provides 21% of the state of California's clean, and by clean, that's a term that's not really linked to renewable energy, because I believe most renewable energy also requires backup or auxiliary fossil fuel plants to keep them functioning when the sun or the wind stops, or when the electric grids need constant level power. Am I correct?
Yes, you're well informed on that. Unlike most people who talk to me about electric power, something we just take for granted, flip a switch and the power comes on.
Now, I'm a great fan of Governor Brown and a lot of other people in the state of California, but you know, I'm over at Stanford. I'm not a Stanford employee, but I make a radio station show here. And you may or may not know, or you may have heard from your friends, that every year at the Silicon Valley Energy Summit at Stanford, I always make a significant painting that is featured at this event. Last the June event, I made a simple little painting. I looked at George Shultz's. Well, I'm only mentioning this to establish my interest in in energy. I looked over George Shultz's shoulder, and I watched him as he was developing his plan, his recommendations for the Congress and for the new president for a new national energy policy and a new climate change national policy. And I could see he included nuclear energy in his recommendations to the Congress and to the new president. So that's how I'm related to Stanford. But around me at Stanford, I get to run into a lot of managers from Slack. You know, people who really, really, like you, have a deep understanding of nuclear energy, and they all roll their eyes at the thought that PG&E would shut down 21% of the clean energy source of this great, important state.
That's right. It has the sixth largest, if it was considered a nation, it would be the sixth largest economy in the world, again, close to 40 million people, very momentous, very large economy. And energy is the foundation that most people don't think about that keeps California humming. Unless, of course, you remember back to the days when Enron was manipulating California's electricity. Now, there was a movie made about it called The Smartest Guys in the Room, which I strongly recommend, because it just shows how incredibly callous these folks were in their quest for more and more profits. Mm-hmm. Have you seen that movie?
I don't know, but I followed the Enron scandal. I think I picked up Jim Sweeney's book, which I think he analyzed. You know, he's the head of the Energy Efficiency Center at Stanford. I think he made a book on it. I read a bit about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was a horrible undertaking by that Texas firm to try to manipulate so many people and in the energy futures market, et cetera. Okay.
Right. Well, they made billions of dollars off of California ratepayers by exploiting loopholes in California's energy deregulation. And that's a very important thing to appreciate. Here we have the lifeblood of our economy being manipulated by an out-of-state entity for their profit.
Yeah.
And I think they caused a substantial multi-billion-dollar loss to the California state gross state product.
Yeah,
It was a huge impact.
Yeah. A little later, I'd like to go pick up on this outer state threat to our policies.
Absolutely.
But before I go there, let me just say, we are all, for the most part, at least in Northern California, dependent on that fine company, PG&E, for our energy. And I know they're working like mad, from what I can determine, in pulling up pipes and putting new pipes in and new safety facilities in to keep from blowing up a lot of us. And I think that's truly wonderful. But could you give me three bullets, or even one if we only have one, three bullets on why PG&E wants to shut down 21% of the state of California's clean energy? You got three?
I've actually just got one, and it's one that everybody's familiar with, and it's the dollar sign. This is all about money. PG&E figured out when they have a huge staff and they do careful financial analysis, and they figured out that the shareholders, again, remember, PG&E is an investor-owned utility, the shareholders could derive greater benefit if the plant were to shut down, because PG&E has become quite a master at an arcane process called Capital Cost Recovery, or CCR for short.
All right. And capital cost recovery, it sounds like the capital they invested in some kind of enterprise, they now have a way of getting out of the deal and recovering maybe the cost of the capital they put in, something like that?
Something like that. A better way to look at it, I think, is to think about a bank.
Yes.
Now, a bank can charge interest if they loan you money. And in the case of PG&E, it is a utility that has to invest large amounts of money in two key areas. And those areas are generation and transmission.
Yes.
Generation, of course, is power plants like Diablo Canyon Power Plant. And transmission is more visible, for example, when you're driving up and down I-5 in the Central Valley and see those mile after mile of steel lattice towers that move large amounts of power north and south in the state. And many of those are owned by PG&E or PG&E entities. And those kinds of assets cost billions of dollars. In the case of Diablo Canyon Power Plant, its current basis, i.e. what the investors invested in, is about $8 billion. That's billion dollars. That's a lot of money. And if you can figure out a way to essentially get 10 to 11% interest on that investment over the useful life of the asset, you've got a great formula for making money.
Yes.
And that's what PG&E is a master at.
All right. So let me paraphrase you a bit and lead to a question I have. Are you saying that PG and its shareholders invested approximately $8 billion in the development of the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant?
That's a good ballpark number to use. So let's use it.
All right. And now, help me with this 10%. How does shutting down the plant enable them to recover all of their investment or some of their investment? Help me here.
Okay, well, actually, PG&E typically recovers many multiples of its investment in its generation and transmission assets. Many multiples. And in the case of Diablo Canyon Power Plant, it went into service first in 1984 after interminable delays, including some caused by PG&E and some caused by discoveries by some shell oil geologists of something called the Hosgree Fault, 3 miles off the shore of Diablo Canyon Power Plant. And so you've got all this bricks and mortar, and we're talking really, really big bricks and a lot of mortar. In the
yes.
case of the containment, it's a 3-foot-thick wall with 6 layers of continuously end-welded rebar that is about the thickness of a typical woman's wrist. It's really big stuff. And they have 6 layers of this embedded in really high-quality concrete, and the idea being to make a structure that is incredibly robust and formed into one of nature's strongest shapes, which are circles and hoops and things and arcs and things like that. And that's what they have to surround the nuclear power reactors, and there are two of them at Diablo Canyon Power Plant and any other nuclear power plant in the Western world, and I want to underscore in the Western world, and we may come around to a topic where we talk about where there's an exception to that or where there was.
All right. I was just thinking about something else as you said something. I could see you're painting a picture that this is a very secure, solid, safe place.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. If there was a big earthquake, it's exactly where I'd like to be. And I've worked at the plant,
right.
So I have some in-person understanding. But it's interesting to know that you can, by advance arrangement, actually get a public tour of the non-nuclear parts of the plant. PG&E runs these tours every third or fourth Wednesday of the month here in San Luis Obispo. You merely call the energy education number, give your name, your driver's license number, and I think your social security number, and your citizenship, and then they run a little mini background check on you, and if you pass all those tests, you're able to come on tour. And I strongly recommend people to go on the tour. I've been on many times.
All right, so it's the third Wednesday of every month. If people would like to have a tour of Diablo Canyon to get a feel for its safety as well as risks or whatever else, they just call PG&E Education Department. And
Energy Education Center. Energy Education Center. I don't have a number in front of me, but you can simply Google that, and you will be given the phone number here in area code 805. That will actually, and you'll talk with probably Diana Turk or somebody like that, who will actually take down your information.
Okay. Wednesday is a day I'm not here at Stanford KZSU Radio, and I have an interest in seeing, having a tour of the plant, and maybe on an upcoming Wednesday in October, maybe I could have a chance to meet you in person.
Absolutely.
But a moment
ago,
you mentioned that several years ago there was a little conflict having to do with a possible earthquake off of. And I'm going to ask you about that, but I also want to say I remember meeting some fellas from the USGS, you know, the United States Geological Survey, the people who study earthquakes that map them. And and I think I remember, but I don't want to say I'm 100% certain. They said to me, that's not by the Diablo Canyon in that the ocean off it. That's not a very active whatsoever geological environment. Am I wrong?
You are absolutely correct. It is a relatively quiet geological environment, but they the PG&E is a very unique among investor-owned utilities in that they have their own seismic safety department, and it's like its staff is like 13 seismic professionals, including several PhDs.
Yes.
And that the result of their work in collaboration with government agencies like the USGS and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is that the area around Diablo Canyon Power Plant is the most heavily studied environment around any power plant anywhere in the world. I mean, they really have done a very excellent job of understanding what the mechanisms are, and of course they have a keen appreciation that the real big action in California will come along the San Andreas Fault, which is the border between the Pacific Plate and the North American Plate, and that's more than 30 miles distant from Diablo Canyon Power Plant. But as anybody who studies California, California's geology understands, the entire state is riddled with historic faults, places where the underlying rock has fractured at one time or another because of the tremendous strains that can be put on it by plate movement. And, of course, there's been a huge amount of plate movement between the North American plate and the Pacific plate. The actual rate is about the same rate that your fingernails grow. But taken over a long period of time, let's say 10,000 years, that distance is roughly the distance of a football field, about 300 feet. And that stress and strain from movement of those plates, which, by the way, is run by a large natural reactor in the center of the Earth that keeps everything warm, keeps the core of the Earth liquid, so that we actually have a magnetic field, and that magnetic field in turn protects organisms like you and I from solar radiation. So we have a natural reactor protecting life here on Earth, and that's something very unique about this planetary system. It would be really cool to have you paint that at some time, Michael.
Oh, thank you. But let me ask, at the center of the Earth, what is the source of energy?
Well, it turns out that Earth is a very unique planet. It has large amounts of two elements, naturally occurring elements, thorium and uranium. Both of those elements undergo a process spontaneously called fission, in which case an element's nucleus actually breaks apart and forms two or more smaller nuclei that in turn, when that happens, release tremendous amounts of heat. And of course, you remember Einstein's famous equation, E is equal to mc squared. There is a slight diminution in mass when that fission or breaking process takes place, and that, of course, is what we're talking about. And we're talking about fission power, which is what powers Diablo Canyon Power Plant.
Okay, so at the center of the Earth, there's thorium and uranium.
Uranium.
And those are two chemicals.
Really? No, they're elements. They're really dense elements. Their density is comparable to lead, about 13 grams per cubic centimeter.
Okay.
So it's really dense stuff, and that turns out to be really important for another piece of what makes this planet so neat, and that is that early in its life, this dense core, besides for helping to keep the Earth's core liquid, also gave this planet a very high density, an average of its what its mass per unit volume is, and that in turn attracted comets. Most comets had large amounts of ice in them, and they crashed into the planet and released that ice as water.
Yes.
And of course, we now have water covering roughly 4/5 of the planet, something very essential for life.
Yes.
But also tied to those two really dense elements, uranium and thorium.
All right.
And this planet is very rich in both.
Yes. All right. Now, I don't know where you're going with the thorium.
Okay. All right. Well, we want to bring ourselves back to Diablo Canyon.
Right.
But I did want to talk about earthquakes.
Yes.
And earthquakes are powered by these essentially convection currents where the heat is being generated in the center of the Earth, and then it's essentially moving towards the outside of the planet, and so moving large amounts of mass, but in turn, also over time, moving the plates of the Earth with respect to each other. And of course, when those plates break, there's something called an earthquake.
Yes.
And there's a really cool natural lab that I do want to put in a little plug for. On your trip down to San Luis Obispo, I also strongly recommend that you go to the Carrizo Plain National Monument. Yep, it's a national monument. And in that national monument is something called Wallace Creek. So Wallace Creek is really amazing because it is the best preserved example of lateral strike slip dislocation or displacement of a stream bed anywhere in the world. So you and I can actually go out there and walk on this living laboratory, and in this living laboratory, you can actually see how much the San Andreas Fault has moved in the what's called Holocene epoch, namely roughly the last 10,000 years. And it really is an eye-opening experience. There's an interpretive trail that was put together by the USGS, and it can really help people to understand the mechanism of how earthquakes occur in California. And again, we have very unique, we have this what's called right strike slip faulting. And that means the blocks are moving side to side. Now, I want to distinguish that from areas, for example, in Alaska, where there are subduction zones, where one plate dives underneath another. And, of course, the result is things like features like Mount McKinley, which is a volcano. So you have volcanism when you have a plate diving underneath another, and you also have a mechanism to generate large tsunamis or sea waves. And we don't have those features anywhere near San Luis Obispo, California. You have to go hundreds of miles away until you get to a subduction zone called the Concordia subduction zone off the coast of Oregon. So anyway, that relates to another thing, because it turns out there's a very lucrative business out there, and that lucrative business we're able to establish in some cases is actually funded by fossil fuel interests. And the fear is to take something that most people don't understand, namely nuclear power, and basically stoke people's imaginations so that they become afraid of something that really was created in somebody's very fertile imagination, and they don't think about it. They want to run around like Chicken Little, screaming, "The sky is falling! The sky is falling! We'd better stop nuclear power! We'd better stop nuclear power!" And in actuality, nuclear power is the safest form of energy of anything that we've invented to date. It's even safer than solar and wind. And the metric is how many people die per terawatt hour or terawatt year of generation. And nuclear is the safest by a very healthy margin.
All right. So let me just add, if I was to come up with data on how many people got asthma, how many people got cancer, how many people got black lung disease, I would find the number is very high. But if I was now to add up all the people that have ever been harmed, killed around the world as a result of nuclear mishaps, the number would be relatively low. Would that be correct?
That's correct. We usually utilize the metric of commercial nuclear power generation. And because of incredibly strict regulations in the United States and in the what are called OECD nations, we find, for example, in the United States that there is a round number of people that have been killed during the operation of nuclear power plants that is tied to radiation. That round number, of course, is zero.
Zero. And that is the thing we fear most about a nuclear mishap, is the spread of radiation, isn't it?
That's right. And we have a couple of good concrete examples now. We look at Three Mile Island. Now, I was earning my PhD at SUNY Buffalo at the time of Three Mile Island, and I was terrified. In fact, I was marching against nuclear power around the time of or after Three Mile Island because I was scared, just like most everybody else. And we actually all had a nuclear reprocessing plant called West Valley just to the southeast of Buffalo. And, of course, we heard lots of horror stories about how that facility was mismanaged. And all those things together, and then it has an interesting personal connection. My thesis committee included a fellow by the name of Fred Manjot Snell, M.D. He was a medical doctor, and he had served in the Army Medical Corps and had a very unique assignment at the end of World War II.
What
he had to go to Hiroshima. He had to go to Hiroshima with a team of medical professionals and survey the survivors. And that gave Fred Snell an absolute, deep to the core of his soul, hatred of atomic warfare. And I share that hatred of atomic warfare. And unfortunately, it was conflated with nuclear power, which is a really different thing. And I want to really highlight the difference and talk about one of the success stories of the American nuclear power industry, which is something called megatons to megawatts, where when the Soviet Union imploded circa 1990, they recognized they needed hard currency. And they had a huge stockpile of highly enriched uranium. Now, that the goal of that highly enriched uranium was to use it to make atomic weapons, to destroy cities, to kill people. And so what the Soviets did was they converted that to what's called downblending with uranium, just ordinary low activity uranium, and made reactor fuel out of it. Because the Soviets knew that once you put that highly enriched uranium or downblended uranium into a reactor, it would make that material useless after only a short time in the reactor for making nuclear weapons. A certain isotope is produced inside a nuclear power reactor, and that isotope protects the remaining fissile material from being used for a nuclear weapon. And so the Soviets made this, they basically said, all right, we're going to sell you the equivalent of 20,000 nuclear weapons. You're going to use it as fuel in your fleet of reactors in the United States, and it'll be a win-win because there'll be 20,000 fewer nuclear weapons in the world, and you'll have essentially power to run your entire reactor fleet for 2 years. I mean, we're talking a huge amount of energy. So, and this was an incredible success story. It worked.
So this happened at the end of the breakup of the Soviet Republic, I guess.
Right.
And
right.
We
right. After that.
And the United States actually did accept all of that uranium that we used to power our plants for a considerable amount of time. And I think what you're doing is bringing up this topic to help us understand that there has been this fear, I believe, and you know, I'm not close to any of these subjects, but this fear that if we helped other countries around the world build nuclear power energy plants, they would have this uranium and in various states and including having used it, but the waste material could be used to build, they could build bombs with it. And what I think you're saying, that's not possible.
Yeah, in fact, one rogue nation has already done the experiment for us. The nation, North Korea, a nation in the headlines today.
Yes.
And their first nuclear test, they used what is called spent nuclear fuel, because there's still a heck of a lot of energy. You only use about 3% of the energy of the nuclear fuel when you put it in a reactor for up to 5 years. And so they took spent nuclear fuel and they said, all right, hey, we can get out some, in this case, they were looking for plutonium-239, because that's the easiest weapon to make. It's a plutonium-239 weapon. And we'll extract the plutonium. It's a chemical process. And we'll make our first successful atomic bomb. And so they did that. But with the plutonium-239 came a much more reactive, what's called isotope. So chemically identical to plutonium, but much more active, much more wanting to split apart. and that isotope is plutonium-240. And plutonium-240 is formed inside of nuclear power reactors, just as is plutonium-239. But the thing is that plutonium-240, it's incredibly expensive to separate the two isotopes, and you have to if you want to make what's called weapons-grade plutonium. Because if you leave it in there, you get a fizzle, F-I-Z-Z-L-E, yield when you take a critical mass and squeeze it using high explosives. That's what the North Koreans did. And guess what? They got a fizzle yield. In fact, some people thought that they just simply detonated a bunch of high explosives and claimed to the world that they were that they had developed a nuclear weapon.
Well,
the U.S., of course, is very understands how to test for those kinds of things. They sent high altitude aircraft over North Korea, and they established that indeed there had been a atomic weapon detonated underground, because there are certain gases are produced and those gases go into the atmosphere. So that is a great vindication of what the Soviets actually did with this megatons to megawatts program. Now, the U.S. was also supposed to get rid of a significant amount of its stockpile. So far, it's welched on the deal, which is something, as somebody who is ardently opposed to atomic warfare, I'm very unhappy about.
Yeah, that's not good. I would like to ask this question. You know, we have nuclear waste. Some of it is generated from power plants. Some of it is generated from the development of weapons. And then, of course, there's some commercial use, like for X-ray machines or whatever. Could you put into perspective how much nuclear waste has been generated by all the power plants in the United States from day one?
Well, the figure that I use is to consider 60 years of U.S. nuclear power operation from our first nuclear power reactor to present. If we were to take all of that, what some call waste, and put it all together, and of course you wouldn't want to do that, but this is a conceptual experiment. But if you put it all together, it would form, and we put it on a football field, and I think we only make it like a couple of meters high, that mass would be between the goal line and the 5-yard line. That's it.
All right. I want to.
So it's incredibly compact.
All right. So I want to paraphrase. So you are saying if over the last 60 years we were to gather up all the nuclear waste that had been generated by all the nuclear power plants in this country, again, 60 years, if you were to put it on one football field, a couple of meters high, and you're saying you wouldn't even need the whole football field for all of that
you just mean
waste.
0 to 5 yards.
So when,
that's like all the high-level waste produced by all of the nuclear power plants.
Amazing. I mean, it's hardly anything. Okay, but so in people's minds, when they fear radiation, you know, which would they see emanating from the nuclear waste, and they think there is mountains, you need a mountain to store it all, what they're really thinking about is the nuclear waste that was primarily created building bombs over the last, I don't know, 60 years or so. Would that be correct?
The really bulky stuff was indeed, in fact, produced at places like the Hanford Reservation in Washington State. They were very, very careless about how they handled radiation back then. And as a result, there are large amounts of it. And right now the U.S. is actively involved. We've started re-emplacing that high-level waste in a place called the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, or WIP, which is located near Carlsbad, New Mexico, in a very safe geological formation called bedded salt, S-A-L-T, sodium chloride. So that's a really good way, if you want to make this stuff, keep it away from the biosphere, and just simply allow it to decay, a good place to put it is thousands of feet underground in a very stable salt bed. And that's what they're doing it with. So again, that's nuclear weapons waste. Now, I want to talk about the nuclear power industry's waste, and I know we have got a huge amount of information to cover here. I see we're already 40 minutes past the hour here, and we've barely scratched the surface. And I want to make sure we get to the really big themes in our conversation. And just as I was hearing the previous guest was talking about, well, there's a lot more to this story. I want people to know there's a lot more to this story, and I want to get back to one of the opening themes. And we'll have to come back, I think, at a later point and talk about this more. That basically the whole concept of nuclear waste is an incredible misnomer, because there's a new generation of reactors being funded by very serious investors, including Bill Gates III, that will actually tap into that remaining 97% of the energy in that so-called nuclear waste and use it to power our society. The pioneering work was done by Dr. Alvin Weinberg, who at the time was the head of the Oak Ridge National Labs, and he developed something called the molten salt reactor, which you may have heard of by now. We're trying to get the word out about it. But again, let's save that for another show. Let's save molten salt reactors for another show. And let's get back to Diablo Canyon Power Plant. Now, Diablo Canyon Power Plant has something called an ISFACI. That's an interim storage facility for its spent nuclear fuel that's cooled down enough. It's been held under a large volume of water in a spent fuel pool. Then it's placed inside of a very thick half-inch stainless steel welded cylinder that in turn is further encased in a massive reinforced concrete structure, 2 foot thick reinforced concrete. And those are the spent fuel canisters, and they're just cooled by natural convection. And that is a very safe way store so-called spent nuclear fuel, but when the time is right, we can again use special machinery, take that stuff out, and put it into one of these new generation reactors and run that reactor for centuries. I mean, it's just really amazing what we can do given the appropriate tools. But unfortunately, we have to get past a big thing called fear. So let's get back to Diablo Canyon Power Plant. Let's get back to the business of generating clean power, power that doesn't generate carbon, while it's producing huge amounts of power, again, 5 Hoover Dams worth. And also, let's think about the recent power, recent demand on our power system. I was watching it very closely, and we came within less than 1% of California's record load during the recent hot spell. There was actually projections that we were going to beat the record that day. That record was set in July 2006. And the thing was that Diablo Canyon Power Plant operated perfectly during that time, supplying 9% of California's power. And that was really, really critical, because we needed every little bit of power that the state could gather and use to, among other things, run all those air conditioners, because air conditioning is incredibly energy intensive. So Diablo Canyon played a very important role in preventing brownouts or blackouts, which is the alternative when you don't have enough power to satisfy the load, brownouts and blackouts.
Okay. So if PG&E goes ahead and a final decision has not been made, or has it, to shut down the Diablo Canyon?
Well, it turns out that the PG&E filed an application on August the 11th, 2016, with the California Public Utilities Commission to have the plant shut down by 2025. And so they opened what's called an application with the California Public Utilities Commission. That application, for those that are interested, is A16080111, I think, or something about like that. Anyway, it's a number that spins around in my head a lot. And a group of citizen experts from all across the state banded together with a nonprofit 501c3 called Californians for Green Nuclear Power Incorporated. We're a fully incorporated nonprofit. And we became what's called an intervener in that application. And there are about 60 interveners, and of course there's PG&E, in this application. And Californians for Green Nuclear Power Incorporated, or CGNP.org, for those that are interested in our website, CGNP.org, is the lone intervener that is advocating for both the environment and the ratepayer, and wants the plant to operate for its design lifetime. It was designed very conservatively by PG&E engineers in the 70s to last a century. That was the plan at the time. And, of course, remember back to CCR, Capital Cost Recovery.
Yes.
That meant that the shareholders were going to get a very slow but steady return on their $8 billion investment. Again, many times what they originally invested over the useful lifetime of the plant. But with deregulation, PG&E admitted in one of their papers filed with the California Public Utilities Commission in this application, they were able to take advantage of accelerated depreciation, which meant they could get more money out of the plant for their shareholders and make the plant, from a bookkeeping standpoint, have a shorter lifetime. And in fact, in this application, 1608006, the plan is to further accelerate the depreciation, so the plant will have a book value of zero by 2025. Now, of course, I believe that means we intend to do a data inquiry of Pacific Gas and Electric, but we believe that when the book value of an asset goes to zero, that you can no longer collect capital cost recovery. But every single penny of that depreciation is actually paid for by the ratepayers. It becomes part of your electric power bill. And mind you, in California, our power bills are some of the highest in the country because this technique of accelerated depreciation means that ratepayers don't get to see the full value of their, if you would properly consider it, their investment in power generation and power transmission facilities because they're being prematurely retired by investor-owned utilities as a way to make more money for their shareholders. Sadly, this is a good example of the 99% their wealth flowing to the 1%.
All right, let me see
if I... As you might guess, I'm an economic populist. I don't think that's a good idea.
All right, let me see if I understand this. With deregulation, it allowed PG&E to change the rate that it depreciates an asset. And you,
that's right, like the Diablo Canyon Power Plant.
You are arguing that more rapid depreciation schedule was the cost was really borne by you and me and the listeners here, the ratepayers, and we bore it
Absolutely.
By higher utility fees.
Is that Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right.
So we have high power rates, and we have the shareholders saying, okay, well, we're going to be happy with throwing away a facility after only 40 years because we can then build natural gas-fired plants and more transmission facilities. Well, we'll throw in some solar and some wind for good PR value, but our real goal is to either through directly through PG&E or through its proxies to add more fossil-fired generation.
Yeah.
So that means that you and I, the ratepayers, are going to see two – we're going to get a double whammy. We're going to get more emissions. Remember, Diablo Canyon is emission-free. So we're going to replace it with facilities, generation facilities that burn fossil fuel either inside the state or outside the state. And then, we have the transmission facilities to move that power large distances. So we got a higher rate for that. And then we also have higher emissions. Now, is that a good deal? That's obviously a rhetorical question. No, it's not a good deal.
So I'd just like to go back to the 10% capital recovery. So once the asset goes down to zero, then the book value goes down to zero, then the investors receive less money.
They receive zero. They receive zero money. That asset, when it's fully depreciated, they get nothing. So the idea is if you can accelerate the depreciation, which is only an accountant's construct, has nothing to do with the underlying physical lifetime of the plant, if you can play fast and loose with that, you can make more money for the shareholders, but you're also wasting valuable resources.
Yes.
Wasting them.
So this,
and of course, one of the rules with the Public Utilities Commission is that this is the rock solid foundation, is that any action has to be in the public interest. And CGMP has made it very clear, a central part of their testimony, that PG&E's planned action is not in the public interest, but instead is to serve the interest of a narrow group of special interests. Now, of course, they go as far as trying to brand this as a so-called joint proposal, but it was a proposal developed in secret and sprung on the world on June 21st, 2016. And while CGMP had been closely working with PG&E to help the public understand the benefits of nuclear power, suddenly we are blindsided like everybody else and by the plant workers to suddenly discover the PG&E's plan is to abandon this plant in 2025, long before the end of its useful lifetime. And, of course, as we dug into it, we discovered that the real motivation was money. And we've also dug in and we found that PG&E applied in 2010 for a license renewal. And there were huge costs associated with that. They did all kinds of capital equipment replacements, including replacing both steam generators, which is an important safety system in the what's called a PWR, like Diablo Canyon is. And they did it properly. They did it during a refueling outage, and they did it just really a tremendous job to replace the steam generators in both reactors to give them another 40-year lease on life. And they, of course, have relicensing costs with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and so on. So we're talking multiple, probably fractions of the billions of dollars that they spent to put this plant in tip-top shape. And then Fukushima Daiichi came, And they said, all right, we're going to shelve these plans. And then, of course, they sharpened their pencils and they figured out, hey, we can make more money if we shut the plant down after its first licensing period rather than applying for relicensing. So while the PUC dismissed without prejudice their application for the recovery of those costs, which, of course, would be paid for by you and I, the ratepayers, they figured out they can make more money by shutting the plant down, which I think is really tragic because this plant is recognized by an independent rating authority called the INPO, or Institute of Nuclear Power Organization, here in the United States, as being in the top quartile. It's a plant that workers want to work at because safety is taken so incredibly seriously at this plant. So the workers know they're safe. The people here in the county, like me, know that we're safe. Because, again, remember back to that zero number. How many people have been killed by the radiation? Zero. Now, yes. Of course, people do end up getting killed in accidents. You know, they fall off a tall structure or something like that. But that has nothing to do with the nuclear power plant part of it. It just has to do with somebody not working safely.
All right.
And, again, Diablo Canyon has what's called a strong safety culture. So they are actually a place where workers want to work because they know that management takes seriously their safety as well as the safety of the public.
All right.
So we have about 4 minutes left here. So where do we want to go in the remaining 4 minutes?
All right. I'm chuckling. You are running the interview. That is okay.
I've also been a radio host before, so I do know the mechanics of the process.
Well,
so,
I hope to learn something from you. So, a couple of things. One, what can the ratepayers do to express their concern about PG&E putting the investors in front of the ratepayers' needs?
Well, they can raise holy you-know-what with the California Public Utilities Commission. There's something called the Public Advisor's Office, which is available at cpuc.ca.gov. Now, the secret in California is you take the state agency, you slap a period behind it, you take CA, the initials of our state, you put a .gov after that, and you have the web address. So once you get to the CPUC website, you'll look up the Public Advisor's Office, and you can learn how you can register your concerns about the actions of PG&E, which has up until June 21st, 2016, been an excellent steward of the plant. And the PUC needs to know that there are ratepayers out there, people paying the bills, people breathing the clean air that want to keep those rates low, and they want to keep the air clean. And we didn't even talk about PacifiCorp, which, of course, we think is the villain behind the scenes in this whole crazy plan, because PacifiCorp has about 9,000 megawatts of dirty fossil-fired generation. And most of the time, that generation is idle. They want to tap into the California market. What a better way to do that than to create an artificial crisis by losing the equivalent of 5 Hoover dams, and then the state will have no choice but to accept dirty coal power, dirty fossil-fired power being imported into California at great cost to the ratepayers. So, again, we'll have those higher emissions, we'll have those higher rates.
Right.
And, again, if PacifiCorp is able to implement its plan, which thankfully was thwarted yet again in the California State Legislature, they tried to sneak it in the last week of the legislature session, and there was a huge protest, and CGNP was one of the parties protesting this plan. And again, right. we've gone to Sacramento. We're really concerned about this. And again, ratepayers should be concerned about what we consider an outrage.
So California, which wants to be seen and actually to be the world leader in reducing greenhouse gas emissions, is now being beset upon by Berkshire Hathaway Company, Pacific Corp., located, I think, in Wyoming, but correct me, that has a tremendous amount of coal. And
they have
expectations of burning that coal and pumping electricity into this state while they...
Over new power lines.
And
that we'll pay for.
And further increasing the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere that help cause things such as Irma, Harvey.
That's right.
All right.
Yeah.
So, all right. I'd like to end now. And
okay.
I'd like to say on Thursday, September the 28th in the afternoon, I will be taking the mic again for several hours. And if you'd like to call in, but you know, schedule it, and we will address a few other topics, including the impact of the shutting down of the Diablo Canyon on the economy of the state, especially the county of St. Louis Obispo. Would you like to do that?
I most certainly would, and I look forward to the opportunity to continue this conversation. And again, for now, I urge your listeners to go out to cgnp.org. Just type that into your browser, and you can learn more about what we've been doing to advocate for the environment and for the ratepayer. So thank you, Michael, for having me.
Dr. Nelson, thank you very much.